All right, y'all, welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos in Austin. Our first guest today is Robert Perry from ConsortiumNews.com. He's the author of Secrecy and Privilege and Neck Deep. And, well, I want a history lesson, and Bob Perry is the man to give it. It's about the Vietnam War and the tapes that came out this week of LBJ cursing the Nixon campaign, basically accusing them, well, not basically, accusing them of, quote, treason, at least in private phone calls, for their interference in his attempt to negotiate an end to the Vietnam War in 1968. How could this be? What is going on here? Welcome back to the show, Bob Perry.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here, and especially when we're talking about Republicans and the chain of criminality that really runs through from the Nixon administration through the vice president's office, through the Reagan campaign and the vice president's office of the 1980s, through the Project for a New American Century and the vice president's office in the last two Bush Jr. terms here. It's one hell of a story. It really does go back to Richard Nixon, doesn't it?
Well, a lot of it does. Nixon sort of set the tone of how Republicans would conduct politics. And my family was Republican back then, but they were sort of the more sort of the New England Republicans. And that was quite different. There was a sense of small government is best. Be careful about how you spend the taxpayers' money and respect for the Constitution. And Nixon, partly out of his own personality and partly out of just a sense of how you have to win at all cost, changed that. He brought a desire to do whatever was needed, even if that meant trying to play tricks, essentially dirty tricks, on his opponents. And in this case, this extraordinary case in 1968, the evidence is now quite overwhelming that his campaign, with his knowledge and essential approval, interfered with Lyndon Johnson's efforts to bring the war in Vietnam to a conclusion.
Well, now let me make sure I understand, because obviously, you know, I'm a young guy. I wasn't born until 76. Well, I like to think I'm young. I actually have a few gray hairs in my beard now, but I wasn't born until 76, so I'm not really sure about all these things. But correct me if I'm wrong, Richard Nixon at this point was nothing but a failed gubernatorial candidate from California. He had no official position of power to do any negotiating on behalf of America whatsoever.
No, he was out of office. Of course, he'd been vice president under Dwight Eisenhower, right. And then he lost to Kennedy in 1960. And then he failed in a run for the governorship of California in 62. He was more or less out of politics for a while, although sort of plotting and scheming on how to get back in. And then in 68, he won the Republican nomination for president. But at the time of these events, in late October of 1968, he was just a private citizen, a nominee for the presidency, but not holding any office.
Mm-hmm.
So he was doing this, and his people were doing this, in a way to block what they saw as the possibility that a peace agreement, or at least significant progress toward a peace agreement, would help Hubert Humphrey, who was Johnson's vice president and running as the Democratic nominee for president. So the move became, how do you stop these peace talks from moving forward? At the time, you also have to remember, there were 500,000 American soldiers in harm's way in Vietnam. This was a war that had already gone on for most of the 1960s, and it escalated in the last few years. But at that point, in 68, Johnson thought he had a real window to end the war, to get the United States out and get some kind of peace deal. And he was trying to get the South Vietnamese government, which the U.S. was supporting, to the bargaining table in Paris. And so the maneuver of the Nixon campaign was to tell President Tu in South Vietnam via various intermediaries, including their ambassador in Washington, to delay, to not show up, to 'cause he would get a better deal if he waited for Nixon to come in than if he did this and possibly helped the Democrats end up winning in 68. So it was a political maneuver, but with promises that President Tu would have more protection, more support from a Republican administration than Democratic one, and two, did agree not to go to these peace talks. And the war went on for 4+ years.
All right. Well, now, on a couple of legalities, I want to know all about the details of how this was arranged and all this. But as far as treason, it's the only crime defined in the Constitution because they didn't want it being thrown around as, you know, Bob Perry's a traitor because he's talking bad about the Republicans while they're in power and that kind of thing. And so it is defined in the Constitution as an overt act of aid and comfort to an enemy. And so I guess... Well, is it simply a matter of interpretation that this, in effect, was helping the North Vietnamese carry on their war?
Well, there also were indications from these tapes that there may have been some overtures to the North Vietnamese as well from the Nixon people. But the clear effort was to get the South Vietnamese to boycott the peace talks. Mm-hmm. And they were, in a sense, not an enemy. But they were a foreign power, and they were operating with their own sense of what was in their interest. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that Johnson was using the technical term of the Constitution when he was talking about this.
Right.
He was basically saying that if you're doing something against your government in a way when there are American soldiers in harm's way, and you're dealing with a foreign power that is continuing that danger or increasing that danger, that's an extraordinary act of for a person running for a high office in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to the extent that it kept America at war against North Vietnam, I guess we need the other Scott Horton, the international human rights lawyer, on here to talk about whether this might actually qualify as treason in front of a grand jury. I'm not so certain it wouldn't.
Well, I think it certainly is. I think that one probably shouldn't get hung up exactly on whether or not there'd be any indictments, because there aren't going to be. The more significant point is that Nixon took action.
It's the extent to which they're betraying their country. I mean, really,
and betraying the soldiers who were in harm's way, many of whom died. More than 20,000 American soldiers died from this point on, mm-hmm. after Nixon won power. So, as well as estimates of around 1 million or so Vietnamese. So there were enormous consequences to the country. Plus beyond that, there was just the disruption that occurred in the United States during that period. Children were turned against their parents, parents against their children. The society was almost being ripped apart, by the continuation of the war from 68 on through 72. So it was, at best, you could say this was something that had horrendous consequences for individuals and for the nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as Nixon was running as the peace candidate who was going to end this terrible Democratic war for us. You know, also I wanted to throw in here the Logan Act, which is, I believe, from the days of Thomas Jefferson, when some guy named Logan was trying to get us into a war with France, and Jefferson was trying not to. And so they passed this law, or some, I forget if you know the exact origin of the name. I don't know what I'm talking about. But anyway, I know it's a crime for Bob Perry to go around making his own foreign policy, whether we would argue later it was for or against the national interest in the larger sense.
Well, you know, I've never really thought of doing that, so I don't really know all the details. But sure, I mean, it basically is really one is a question of judgment and a reckless behavior on the part of Nixon, with a sense of his fierce ambition to gain power and really sort of an anything goes mentality, and that sort of has colored how the Republicans have approached power, really ever since. And to a degree that most people don't know, Nixon remained almost virtually to his death, a significant advisor to the Republican Party. Many of their people that were running for office later would go to his go visit him when he was living. I think most of the time he's outside New York, but sometimes also in California, and they would consult with him about what to do. And he was we have some of this because one of his assistants went around tape recording him in his last few years, Monica Crowley. And her book is quite revealing of Nixon, even to the extent of going into the Clinton years, where he's advising the Republicans to go after Clinton, to try to impeach Clinton, as sort of payback for what the Democrats had done to Nixon over Watergate. And he was also consulting with people seeking office. He was pushing Bob Dole to be the nominee in 1996, and Dole, of course, did get the nomination that year. So you had Nixon really up to his final days, still plotting, still bitter, still conniving, still advising the Republicans to play that kind of politics.
Mm-hmm. Boy, and when you say anything goes, too, again, I wasn't in existence yet, but from the way I was told when I was a kid, 1968 was the year that America was basically being torn apart at the seams. That for Nixon, I mean, him running as the peace candidate and promising, you know, peace with honor as soon as possible and those kinds of things, that was really the essence of what let him squeak by and win in the first place. And he had to have perceived just how tenuous social relationships were here in the United States at the same time that the Vietnam War is one of the main driving factors behind all of this. He's in tune with it enough that he's got to run as the peace candidate and yet is cynical enough to completely betray that.
Right. It's quite interesting to hear his conversations because he's on some of these tapes too. While the key tapes that were released last week by the Johnson Library were between Lyndon Johnson and Senator Everett Dirksen, who was the Republican leader in the Senate at the time. And of course, Johnson, having been a longtime senator himself, knew Dirksen. And so when Johnson is getting this information, some of it through wiretaps, because they were wiretapping the South Vietnamese embassy. They were wiretapping Anna Chenault, who was known as the Dragon Lady. She was part of the China lobby and one of the right-wing intermediaries between the Nixon campaign and the South Vietnamese. So they were getting this information from very reliable but very sensitive sources, technical sources. And as Johnson sort of learns of this, he calls Dirksen and says, "This is outrageous," and that's the quote where he talks about this is treason, what they're doing. And Dirksen says he agrees with the president's assessment, and says I'll have to talk to them. So Dirksen then goes and presumably talks to Nixon. The next day, Nixon calls up and offers a rather lame, self-serving claim that he wasn't really doing any of these things, even though Johnson had pretty strong evidence that he was. And then Nixon says, "Well, we're at a point where the war could be brought to an end. I certainly don't want to disrupt that." But then he goes ahead and disrupts it. So you have this Nixon, this sort of conniving character on the phone with Johnson. Johnson has a cold during this time, and here he is, though the president's coughing but being fairly diplomatic but blunt at the same time. He would try to sort of soft pedal little things like some of these points because he didn't want to really raise the stakes too high. But he also was pretty stern as well, and increasingly angry as these conversations go forward. Just before the election, Johnson learns that a Christian Science Monitor reporter is onto the story and is trying to get confirmation. And so Johnson talks to Clark Clifford, who was then Defense Secretary, and Rusk, who was the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk. And he's asking, "What should I do? Should we take this? Should we confirm this? Should we go public?" And Rusk and most eloquently, Clifford say, "No, you shouldn't." And Clifford says, "This is really horrendous stuff that's happened here, but it'll be bad for the country if the American people learn of this." And so he says, "It will not be in our national interest for this to come out." So basically, you also get not just how the Republicans are becoming increasingly hardballish in playing tough, even to this level. But you're also seeing how the Democrats and the establishment, Clifford being a pillar of the establishment in Washington at the time, how they were kind of deciding, "Well, we shouldn't let the American people in on this stuff because it's too ugly. It would raise doubts about the legitimacy of our government. It would interfere with how we go about our foreign policy. So let's just, you know, keep this under wraps. Let's mm-hmm. sweep it under the rug, basically, for the good of the country," as the phrase would go. And so you see a lot of what has happened since. This sort of decision that the American people are kind of like children and they really shouldn't be told some of these hard truths about how their government really functions and who is really running their country. Because that would shake their childlike beliefs and how the government is working.
Right.
Yeah. Ironically, what it's done is it's fed a lot of paranoia. It's fed a lot of conspiracy theories, some of which are completely nonsensical. But there also are cases where there were real scandals, real conspiracies that the public has been kept from. As that pattern continued, the Republicans continued to play hardball with in how they approach things. Obviously, Watergate was one case where that which kind of blew up in their face. But they continued with this. And you saw in 1980 that trying to undercut Jimmy Carter on his hostage dealings with Iran, another scandal that the Democrats helped sweep under the rug when that was investigated as part of the Iran-Contra scandal. Iran-Contra kind of came out as sort of another surprise for them. But it really, the Democrats have always approached this as, let's not have this go too far, because my goodness, it will shock, it will shake the belief of the American people in their government. So let's play it nice. The Republicans say, wow, that they see the weakness on the part of the Democrats, and so they just play it harder. And we've continued to see that pattern almost until the present day.
Yeah, I'd rather lose an election than tell the truth. It's the same thing that happened in 1960 when Kennedy came out and pretended that the Soviets were way ahead on intercontinental ballistic missiles, and Nixon knew better and kept his mouth shut on that one.
Well, I think some of what Nixon was doing was what he considered payback for the Democrats, at least his narrow, bitter defeat in 1960. And now, some of that can be debated. I mean, obviously, politics is not the sweetest business of all. Everyone plays a little bit nasty, but I think what Nixon, with his personal chip on his shoulder attitude, saw anything that was done to him and just sort of escalated up the ladder. It's interesting. Another thing I include in the piece I posted last night was that about the Johnson tapes, was that if you dial forward to the beginning of the Watergate scandal, 1972, Nixon is bugging the Democratic National Committee and learning essentially what their strategies are, what their vote tallies are for McGovern versus other possible candidates at the convention coming forward. And so these burglars go in a second time to sort of fix some of the bugs and add some more, and they get caught in June of 72. Nixon then begins to coordinate. We have, of course, the tapes from his office too. So he starts coordinating how to respond to this. And one of his strategies is to pressure Lyndon Johnson and to get Johnson to intervene with the Democrats, to get the Democrats to halt the Watergate investigation. And one of Nixon's complaints is that Johnson had bugged his campaign in 68 in relation to these secret contacts that were being made with the South Vietnamese. So Nixon then has used the fact that he was doing what he was doing, and his people were dealing with the South Vietnamese behind Johnson's back, but Johnson learned about it through wiretaps, effectively. So that becomes an excuse for Nixon to do Watergate and then try to use that information, which Johnson had helped keep secret, supposedly for the good of the country, against Johnson, to blackmail Johnson into getting the Democrats to halt the Watergate investigation. So it's kind of an interesting story that we can now piece together from a variety of very reliable sources, because for some reason these two guys were taping a lot of their conversations with folks. And we've had other information from the various records that have come out over the years to fill in much of the gaps. So we know that we have it's been reported by some investigative reporters have dug out things like the actual cables that went from the South Vietnamese embassy to Saigon, relating to their dealings with the Nixon campaign. We also have the memoir of Anna Chenault, the Dragon Lady, who was one of the chief intermediaries, and she talks about who was giving her instructions and how she was being told to make sure that she doesn't tie it back to the Nixon folks. So we know an awful lot about this scandal. But the other amazing thing to me, though, in the last week was this came out, and it got virtually no attention in the major news media.
Right, even with the T word in there in the headline.
Right, the AP did a fairly cursory job reporting that Johnson had accused the Nixon team of treason, but they really didn't go into any detail, provided no context. They included Nixon saying it wasn't true, basically, and they sort of soft-pedaled it.
Yeah, that ought to be good enough for you, Perry. Nixon says it's not true. No, all right, so wait, tell me all about the Dragon Lady, Anna Chennault. Who is this lady, and what she got to do with all how this worked out?
Well, Anna Chennault was a very attractive Chinese woman, and if you remember going back to the period even earlier, the so-called McCarthy era, when the United States, when China fell to the communist forces of Mao Zedong, Chiang Kai-shek, who was the right-wing sort of nationalist leader, was driven out of China, fled to the island of Taiwan, where the nationalists have sort of remained in power ever since. But so Chiang Kai-shek and his supporters, some of whom were very influential in Washington, began to stir up these accusations that the Democrats, people in the Truman administration, had basically sold out the Chinese to the communists, that this was part of the plot to by traitors inside the U.S. government to give countries to the communists. Now, and that fed basically what we know as the McCarthy era. So Anna Chennault, who then she married a general who was who was known for the Flying Tigers, which had been a supply operation during World War II to supply the nationalist Chinese. She ended up marrying this American officer, and she became a prominent socialite figure in Washington in terms of building support for the nationalist Chinese movement and continuing this hostility toward communist China, or ramping it up. So that was sort of her background. So she was a part of of what you might consider a right-wing infrastructure in Washington. These were very well-funded activities that were designed to put a lot of pressure on the U.S. government to build up the military and be more aggressive when it came to things like communist insurgencies. That's why she was a factor in relating to Vietnam, because the argument that was facing Johnson during this time was that he was being accused of losing Indochina, much as Truman had been accused of losing China. And Johnson was scared stiff that would be part of his legacy. So he began to respond to that by building up American forces in Vietnam, and led to what we know as the Vietnam War.
And now, what about the role of Henry Kissinger in this? Because if I remember right, Christopher Hitchens, in his movie, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, talks about, I guess, he was really the one organizing this whole thing, right?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point, because obviously the first time this really sort of became, this story was sort of known to the American people at any level, was in 1983 with the publication by Seymour Hersh of his biography of Henry Kissinger. And in it, Hersh describes the role that Kissinger played in organizing, or because Kissinger was being consulted behind the scenes by the Johnson people. He was part of the effort of getting the peace talks going in Paris. But he was then back-channeling that information to the Nixon people, describing to them the various strategies that Johnson was following in order to bring peace to Vietnam and to get the American troops out. So that became the spark plug that led the Republicans to then say, well, how can we stop Johnson from doing these things that Kissinger had been told about, that is, bringing the parties together in Paris for peace settlement? Kissinger played a key role in this. Now, it appears, and there are still a lot of things we don't know, but it appears that Vice President nominee Spiro Agnew was another key figure, along with John Mitchell, who then was essentially campaign manager for Nixon, later, of course, became the attorney general and was implicated and convicted in the Watergate scandal years later. But you had this crowd who were part of Nixon's entourage in various ways. But Kissinger was sort of in between the two camps. He was pretending to be helping the Johnson people, but he was ingratiating himself with the Nixon crowd. And ultimately, of course, he became Nixon's national security advisor, and later Secretary of State. So it helped his career along mightily.
Well, it sounds like he ought to be rotting in a prison cell right now or something, no?
Well, I mean, one could argue that. And it's interesting that Kissinger also plays a role in the 1980 October surprise case, which I've looked at a lot because it was, because, you know, I did the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s, and as we would sort of look back and try to figure out how did this start, we found increasingly there was a lot of evidence pointing to the Republicans making their first contact with the Iranians in 1980 during their campaign. And again, Henry Kissinger shows up. And by the way, so does Richard Nixon, oddly. Richard Nixon was involved with some of the old CIA guys in 1980 coming up with schemes for how to, you know, how they would deal with Iran. They were kind of like sort of, they weren't really part of the government at all, but they were still acting like they were. And they were contemptuous of Jimmy Carter and his failure to get the hostages out. And in that mix comes Henry Kissinger, who was, you know, remember, because he'd been David Rockefeller's guy, and Rockefeller was the chief banker. Chase Manhattan was the chief banker for the Shah of Iran. So you had a lot of these interesting connections going that way too. Some years, this is a dozen years later,
when
the Republicans are playing a similar kind of game. How do you make because they thought that Jimmy Carter was trying to get the hostages out right before the election to tip the election his way in 1980 and defeat Ronald Reagan. So their goal was, how do you make that not happen? And that became known as the October surprise case.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up David Rockefeller there. I remember in Barry Goldwater's memoirs, he has a chapter called Jimmy Who? And it's about how here you have Henry Kissinger, who's basically Nelson Rockefeller's guy, is the foreign policy guy for Nixon and Ford. And then Carter comes in and he's got Zbigniew Brzezinski, David Rockefeller's guy, running things in his administration. And they just switch back and forth again between these two brothers and their political operatives.
Well, I mean, that is how the establishment sort of works. I mean, not to be too obvious, but there are these people that are supposedly, quote, respected from all sides. We're seeing it even now in the transition, on the Obama transition, where the establishment is just thrilled that Obama is putting in place all these people that they feel who are part of this grouping of who's respected in Washington.
The so-called realist school.
Well, my sure it's even the neocons, who are not at all realists, are part of the establishment now in Washington. They're very well respected. They have important positions. They're welcomed onto the op-ed pages of the New York Times, and they basically control the Washington Post. So the neocons, who are ideologues, are also part of this establishment. And then you have people like Robert Gates, who essentially always acted like a neocon, although maybe he is more of an opportunist. But he's embraced by the establishment. They love him. And the way it kind of works is that certain people are blessed in this group, and there really isn't a lot of change from one party to the next. I mean, there's some emphasis perhaps, and some might be harder line than the other, but a lot of it stays the same.
Yeah, Fred. So, by the way, and forgive me for being such a kook on this issue, but do you know what David Rockefeller is up to nowadays?
Gee, I don't know. I mean, I haven't really. I went through his memoir. It came out, I don't know, maybe several years ago, and I went through that, culling it for information. Like a lot of memoirs, it really wasn't that revealing. Mm. But it was interesting how he played a key role, of course, in 1980 in dealing with the Shah's problems. Because the Shah of Iran, after being overthrown in 79, began wandering the world, sort of like a guy looking for a port to anchor his boat. The Flying Dutchman, he was called. I think Kissinger came up with that line about him. But David Rockefeller was approached by the Shah's sister, Princess Ashraf, in a meeting they had in New York, and Rockefeller is importuned by Ashraf to help her brother, who's also suffering from cancer, get medical treatment and a place to live. And so essentially, Rockefeller agrees. It turns out, of course, that Chase Manhattan has a lot of money that the old Iranian government had deposited, and the new Iranian government wanted to withdraw. So it was in the interest of Chase Manhattan to make sure that money didn't go back to Tehran, because it was essentially bankrupted the bank at that time. So you have this sort of this intrigue of getting Jimmy Carter to allow the Shah to enter the United States, and it was Kissinger and David Rockefeller played key roles in that. And when they finally did get Carter to agree to allow the Shah to get treatment for his cancer, that's what provoked the uprising in Tehran that led to the hostages being seized at the U.S. Embassy.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys have always been playing mischief in their various ways. And while they pretend to do these things for the best interests of the United States, it's often what's in their interest.
Well, yeah, and it often backfires even against their own interests, but I guess that's why they have the Federal Reserve to bail them out. Where do I want to go? Oh, I wanted to go to October Surprise then from there, because now, you know, they have the consequences of the revolution, which I wish I could memorize these Middle Eastern names better. But there was a great article on antiwar.com, say, about 6 months ago or so, about how certain people in the State Department actually were in favor of, because the Shah was on his way out anyway. He was sick, like you say, and he had to be replaced with somebody. And some of them basically gave the okay. I don't know how widespread the agreement was in the government, but some of them seemed to pretty much give the okay for the Ayatollah Khomeini to take over. And then, of course, you had the uprising at the embassy and the taking of the hostages and all that, which ended up backfiring in their face. So then the Republicans, as you have reported so thoroughly, and I forget which book is it. Is it Secrecy and Privilege?
Secrecy and Privilege probably has the most detailed version of this. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I know Gary Sick wrote a great book called October Surprise about this. What exactly was the deal? How, I mean, I think most people know the outline of at least the accusation that the Republicans actually convinced the Iranians to hold the hostages longer, to wait until Ronald Reagan took office in order to hurt Jimmy Carter. So I guess basically I'd like the overall briefing on it, if you can, and particularly with an eye to the role of George Bush Sr., which seems to always get underplayed or downplayed.
Right. Well, I think in some ways, if you look at what happened in 68 as a precursor to what happened in 1980, you'd see a lot of parallels. Again, it was a case where the Democrats were in power. They were facing a serious crisis. There was an effort to achieve some kind of settlement, that the settlement, if it had occurred right before the election, could have tipped the election away from the Republicans to the Democrats. And so the Republicans went about their position was essentially that Carter was doing the bad thing, that he was trying to have this well-timed hostage release that would help him politically. So they began investigating this and sort of figuring out what Carter was up to. And they brought in a lot of old CIA people who had worked for the former CIA director George H.W. Bush. And they've been part of his campaign before he joined with Reagan as the vice presidential nominee. So they kind of swung over to the Reagan Bush campaign, and they continued this effort to monitor and to essentially make contacts of their own, and to in one level try to figure out what Carter was up to, how far along the negotiations were. But that it seems to have evolved into something similar to what we saw in 68, passing on messages to the Iranian government that they would get a better deal, a better shake, if they dealt with the Republicans than with the Democrats. And there was also a lot of hatred in Tehran for Jimmy Carter. He had praised the Shah, if you remember, before the Shah fell, and he was considered sort of a sanctimonious guy. They didn't like him at all. So there was this. And plus, some of them did have relations going back with the CIA. Khomeini himself had received some levels of protection from the U.S. intelligence services when he was in Paris. So there was this history, and we know a lot about this, even though it's remained on an official level murky. But there was, for instance, a very detailed letter that the president of Iran, Bani Sadr, sent to the an investigation that was being done in the House of Representatives in 1992 that dealt with this issue, and he described in detail the efforts by the Khomeini people to set up a deal with the Republicans, and he Bani Sadr opposed it, thought the deal should have been done with the Democrats who were in office at that time, and that this crisis should have been ended effectively by releasing the hostages. So there was this internal battle inside Iran, which the Republicans fed into. We also have a lot of evidence from for instance, even the PLO people were approached by the Republicans with this idea that they could go to Iran, and Arafat actually did go to Iran, and convey the desire of the Republicans to work out their own deal with the Iranians. There was there have been witnesses from Israeli intelligence, from French intelligence, that there were these meetings that went on both in Madrid, Spain, where and these allegations, Bill Casey took part. He was then the chairman of the Reagan campaign. He was, and he later went on to be CIA director. But Casey had these had various meetings. Casey also had a lot of interesting ties with the Kissinger Rockefeller crowd.
I wanted to ask you one thing. Just came up. I didn't want to interrupt you, but you just gave me the perfect opportunity. I seem to remember, and I'm sorry because I can't remember where I read this, but I believe I read somewhere that Reagan made a deal with David Rockefeller that he would get their support if he would nominate Bush to be his vice president and bring Casey in on his campaign and then put him in the administration.
Well, Casey was already in the Reagan campaign. He comes in at the time of the New Hampshire primary, but Casey was a person who had dealings with that crowd from New York. Casey was, of course, basically a New York wheeler dealer lawyer type. The as far as Bush, clearly this Bush was a favorite of the David Rockefeller crowd. Now, I don't know personally whether or not there was some face to face meeting where such a deal was struck, but clearly Reagan was bringing in that wing of the party, and also bringing in these old CIA guys who had been basically cashiered under Jimmy Carter, and they were very angry about what Carter had done to them. So they sort of joined the campaign too, and that provides an important impetus to this kind of skullduggery that is at the core of the October surprise story. But you have Casey, you have a lot of evidence now that George H.W. Bush, much like Agnew may have done as the vice presidential nominee in the 1968 matter, Bush may have played a similar role for the 1980 matter. Because, you know, essentially, if you're a foreign power and you're negotiating with someone who's not actually in power in the United States, you would want someone who you know is going to be there. If this group wins. Now, a lot of the operatives might not be there. They might get jobs, they might not. But a vice presidential nominee is going to be there if that party wins. So it may be that there were needs to have assurances from somebody who was essentially in the line of command for the incoming government. But it appears that Bush played a similar role with in the 1980 matter. And another name that has been brought in by several of these sources, including some documented sourcing, was Robert Gates. Robert Gates had been a CIA guy under Poppy Bush. He had he was sort of very ambitious. He was trying to move up through the ranks. He'd worked for Carter's White House for a while on the NSC staff, and then came back to work as an executive assistant to the CIA director Turner. And then the allegations are that he and some other people who were still in the CIA collaborated with some of their old colleagues who had left the CIA in helping the Republicans pull off this scheme of making their own separate deal with the Iranians. And then whether or not that's true, I mean, there's a lot of evidence it is true, but whether it is true or not, what we do know is that after Casey was put in at CIA, Bob Gates, his career skyrocketed. He was picked out of relative obscurity and made the head of the analytical division, where he then began changing the whole way that the CIA approaches information. As you know, they used to have an old policy of providing what they called bark on intelligence, real tough, whatever the facts are, ma'am, kind of stuff. And it was Bob Gates who got them to essentially politicize everything and exaggerate certain threats. So it would fit with what the policymakers in the Reagan administration wanted to do. For instance,
right, he's the guy who was saying that the Soviet Union was 10 feet tall when they were imploding around him.
Right, and really the interesting thing is that the agency knew that the Soviet Union was imploding. I've talked even to people on the operations side who said there are the best U.S. sources inside the Soviet government, and the U.S. had some very good sourcing. They were describing the collapsing Soviet Union. This is as early as the 1970s. And certainly by the 1980s, it was well known, and there were many of the criminologists, the Mel Goodmans, Ray McGovern types, who were warning of this too. So what Gates did is he essentially moved those guys out and moved in malleable analysts who were very career-oriented, who would deliver the intelligence that the Reagan administration wanted to hear, that if the Soviet Union was 10 feet tall, that it was on the march, that the U.S. better build up the military budget, the U.S. better go and intervene in all these little brush fire wars around the world. And ironically, that was the reason that the CIA missed the collapse of the Soviet Union, but it really didn't miss it as much as it had been politicized to such a degree that was an answer that the Reagan and Bush people didn't want to get. So the agency, under Bob Gates's control in this regard, gave them the information they wanted. And many of the people that Gates put in remained with the agency in high positions right up through the WMD mess in Iraq, where they played a similar role, where they gave the White House what they knew the White House wanted to hear, that there was this huge threat from Iraq, much like they exaggerated the threat from the Soviet Union. So you have but going back to the 1980 matter, we do know that Gates, his career skyrocketed for some reason after the Reagan people got in. So there's just been a lot of evidence, and I go through it in some detail in Secrecy and Privilege, trying to lay out, because some of it does get a little complicated, and there are counterclaims, and I have to deal with those too, of why certain claims that there were efforts to debunk this story in the early 1990s that were fairly effective, at least in debunking them, even though the stories themselves turned out to be false. Newsweek and the New Republic did cover stories based on an alibi they had bought into for Bill Casey's whereabouts on a key day, and it turned out they'd gotten it completely wrong. And we later were able to show, based on witnesses who were at the place that Casey was supposedly at for this alibi, that the Newsweek and New Republic stories were wrong. But they never corrected them, and there was such a desire by that point, even among the Democrats, in late '92 after the election, which was putting Bill Clinton into office, that there was no real interest in pursuing the truth. The interest was in trying to be bipartisan and not embittering the Republicans. This is the Democratic side of this dysfunctional relationship that we have between the Republicans and Democrats. The Republicans play these really, it's like they're the abusive husband, and the Democrats play the role of the cowering wife.
Well, and they do it the other way around when the other side's in power, and we're about to watch at least 4, maybe 8 years of that, too.
Well, I'm not sure they do, really. I mean, they didn't under Clinton. Basically, the Democrats took it on the chin over and over again with all these investigations that were over trivial matters compared to the kinds of things that the Republicans had been doing.
Yeah, but see, Bob, now here's where I'll differ with you. They were investigating a bunch of trivial matters compared with the things that Clinton was doing, such as sending the Army's Delta Force to burn the Branch Davidians to death, such as covering up the FBI informants' involvement in the Oklahoma bombing and the disappearance of there ever was a John Doe number 2 in the fake intelligence for bombing Sudan, in the fake never existed mass graves in Kosovo.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I agree with all those points. I think they're more complicated than you're laying them out. But I don't recall the Republicans pressing for any of those investigations.
No, that's what I'm saying. They went after Whitewater and Paula Jones and a bunch of BS.
Right, exactly. And so that my point is that the Republicans made a determination, really starting in '93, that they were going to impeach or destroy Bill Clinton and get back in power through his destruction. And that led ultimately to his impeachment over his sexual misconduct with Paula Jones or with Monica Lewinsky. But then, and they did actually achieve much of what they wanted. They set the stage for George W. Bush getting the presidency in 2001.
Right, and then, of course, we've talked about this before, too, and this is really the lesson, I think, of this entire thread of history going back to 1968, and that was this meeting that Seymour Hersh reported, where it was like the Iran-Contra alumni got together, I guess, I don't know if it was actually in the vice president's office, they're all standing around having drinks or whatever, talking about the lessons and of all these various covert operations. And the lesson really is, use the vice president's office, keep the CIA and the military, you know, as much on the sidelines as possible, use the National Security Council. These are the best ways to skirt the law and get away with bloody murder.
Well, that's certainly what they learned out of Iran-Contra. And again, Iran-Contra was a scandal that the Democrats did everything they could not to investigate. I was writing about that for the Associated Press, at least the Contra side of it, and Ollie North's secret operations to keep the Contras funded. He was, of course, using the NSC. He was working closely with the Vice President, Vice President Bush's office, and we were able to really break that down, and in a number of stories, including the Contras getting involved with drug traffickers as another way to finance themselves. So we had all that, and when the Democrats were kind of pushed into looking at it in the summer of '86, Lee Hamilton, who was then chairman of the Intelligence Committee, went over to the White House with Dick Cheney, who was then a congressman from Wyoming and a member of the committee, and Henry Hyde and some other people. And they sat down with Ollie North and with our story and said, is this true? And he said, no, it's not. And they basically said, oh, okay, that's good enough for us. And one of Hamilton's guys called me afterwards. I was at the AP office in D.C. and I was told we've looked into this, and, you know, your story doesn't check out. And we have a choice between believing these honorable men, people in the White House, or your sources, and it's not a close call. So that was the extent of their investigation, really, at that time. And only was because one of North's last planes that he was sending to drop weapons to the Contras got shot down.
The Hassenfuss plane, right?
Right, on October 5th of 1986, that the story began to unravel. And there were too many facts. So the Democrats did everything they could not to investigate this story. And then once they started investigating it, when, you know, that happened, there was also the disclosure in the Middle East about the Iran operation, which now appears to have been a sequel to the 1980 October surprise stuff. It was sort of the Reagan had continued secretly sending weapons to the Iranians, seemingly out of that relationship that was built up some years earlier. And when that broke, the Democrats were involved. Neither was the Washington Press Corps. And then things got sort of out of control for a while for the Republicans, and they had a little scandal, Iran-Contra. But very quickly, for the good of the country, and I was actually at some of these dinner parties where this sort of language is used. We have to basically deceive the American people for the good of the country. We can't take this to the fullest extent. We can't find all the truth, because if you do that, then you got to impeach Ronald Reagan, and who wants to do that? That's just too messy. So the decision becomes, let's just do a kind of a political investigation. We'll bring out a few things. We'll slap some wrists. We'll try to keep the president, and in this case also the vice president Bush, out of the line of fire, because, oh my God, that would be too terrible if we implicated them in all this. We'll sort of lay it at the feet of an Ollie North, maybe John Poindexter, his boss, a few other people. They called them the men of zeal. And we were supposed to believe that they'd kind of done all this without their higher-ups knowing anything. And it was kind of a preposterous story, but it's more or less what the Democrats and agreed to sort of put out. And the Republicans were even angry at that. They did their minority report, which Dick Cheney was involved in writing, along with David Addington. And they basically said the president should be allowed to do whatever he wants. And Cheney has later, in 2005, Cheney referenced that back when he was explaining how his view of the imperial presidency had developed, and he refers you back to that minority report that was issued in 1987.
Well, and I think Frontline or something, one of those said that he was watching Nixon get on the helicopter and leave out one of the windows in the White House, mm-hmm. and just couldn't bear the idea that a president would ever have to bow down to the Congress and leave his position. He would never let that kind of thing happen on his watch again.
Well, you know, much of what the Republicans did after that in terms of building their right-wing media and all the rest of it was to prevent another Watergate. That was the phrase they would use. We will not allow another Watergate.
Right. Not that they'll stop being criminals, but they'll stop letting themselves get in a position where they could ever be held the slightest bit accountable for it.
That's right.
All right, I'm sorry, because I got 100 more questions. I want to ask you all about Eric Edelman and 100 other things. I could keep you on the phone for 3 hours, but Bob, you got to go and I got to go and the interview's over. I'm sorry.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye. All right, everybody, that's Robert Perry from Consortium News. And by the way, they're still doing their fund drive. It's economic times have hit hard, but consortiumnews.com is such an excellent website. It's an indispensable resource. Please share whatever you got, 5, 10, 50 bucks, whatever you can do. They're doing their fund drive still at consortiumnews.com. Go and help them out. The books, again, are Secrecy and Privilege and Neck Deep. This is Anti-War Radio, and you know what? The next interview doesn't start till the bottom of the hour, and I could have kept him on. I could have asked all about Eric Edelman, and I forgot. Oh, well, that's it. All right, well, we're Anti-War Radio. We'll be back here. Dang.